It is Friday, April the 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, the death of a music legend.
He was, to put it lightly, a genius, a musical genius, almost a personification of funk.
Also ahead, efforts to stabilize the Middle East.
They are looking for ways that they can agree on more and work together on more things in the Middle East.
Also choosing the next U.S. president, plus putting a famed African-American on the $20 bill. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. American pop icon Prince, known by such hits or for such hits as When Doves Cry, Purple Rain, of course, Little Red Corvette, and I Want to Be Your Lover, has died. He was 57. The artist's publicist confirmed his death after reports that police were investigating a death at his home outside of Minneapolis, Minnesota. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about his life, the music, and the death of Prince.
A shock to all of us. I do believe that he was suffering from diabetes. There was a report that he admitted that he had been suffering from epilepsy some years ago. But again, at this moment, we don't know exactly what the cause of death is. We know that foul play has been ruled out, which will lead us to believe that it was natural causes.
His catalog goes all the way back to the 1970s.
Yes.
I remember his first album, his first hit, I Want to Be Your Lover, in high school.
Mm-hmm.
We played the grooves off of that record, and he was a phenomenal guitar player. He was a phenomenal bass player, which a lot of folks don't realize. He was a composer. He could tell you if the speaker stacks were out of phase. He was, to put it lightly, a genius, a musical genius, almost the personification of funk.
Oh, absolutely. And pop, because he had that, and R&B, because he had those elements as well, and rock, because we heard a lot of rock influence in some of his latter stuff. Now, I was introduced to Prince a little later on, during the Purple Rain phase. I had the album and played it over and over again. One of my favorite songs still to this day is When Doves Cry.
Why do we scream at each other?
Prince was always ahead of his time. He was always a very provocative artist in terms of the kinds of things that he sang about, the themes, but also, like you say, musically, he was not afraid to experiment with different sounds and textures and instruments. And I remember him sort of being the first artist that kind of brought sort of that electric sound into music, along with the more acoustic traditional sounds of the instruments that he played. And I think it's also very important, as we remember Prince, to not only remember him as a musical genius, but also to know that he was an activist. He was very, very active in terms of artists' rights. You may remember later on, I think it was sort of the 90s, when we couldn't call him Prince anymore.
Right, he became a symbol, a hieroglyph.
The artist formerly known as Prince, and this was because he was in a huge legal battle with Warner Brothers. And he was also a social activist and a civil rights activist. I mean, if you go back and listen to some of his songs, he was very much aware of what was going on in the U.S. He was also aware of some of the issues around the world, and those things found their way into his songs as well. Another one of my all-time favorite songs is Sign of the Times. And if you listen to that song, you hear a man who was saying, listen to what is going on in inner city America. Be aware of what is happening and how this is affecting us all.
What do you think? Send us a tweet. You can send one to Shauna. She is at VOA Lady DJ or at VOA underscore music. Look for more of our coverage of the life and the death of Prince on our website, voanews.com.
And as you might imagine, the world of social media has been all abuzz about Prince's death. To look at all of that, International Edition social media expert G. Abby Lee joins us. G., what you got?
Hi, Steve. Sure. Another well-known musician and a friend of Prince was tweeting a lot Thursday, and that musician is Questlove, who is on Twitter at Questlove. To give you an idea of what he's tweeting, one of them reads like this: Long live the king. Another one reads, I can't breathe right now. And you know you're an American icon when the President of the United States writes about your death on Facebook. President Obama wrote more than 100 words on his death that began like this: Today the world lost a creative icon. Michelle and I join millions of fans from around the world in mourning the sudden death of Prince. He ended the statement with, Our thoughts and prayers are with his family, his band, and all who loved him.
And what's the public reaction been like to the president's posting?
Many people are commenting with lyrics from his songs, and one song in particular seems to be the crowd favorite. It's titled, Let's Go Crazy. That's all for me today, Steve.
And many thanks to you, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. You know, you can find G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And you can follow International Edition on Twitter at VOA_IE.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
And also in the news, President Obama has concluded his visit to Saudi Arabia, saying the United States and the Gulf state leaders remain united in efforts to destroy the Islamic State militants and stabilize the conflict-ridden Middle East. Speaking at the close of Thursday's summit with the Six-Nation Gulf Cooperation Council, Mr. Obama reaffirmed the U.S. commitment to, in his words, deter and confront aggressions against his partners and allies in the region. VOA White House correspondent Mary Alice Salinas is traveling with the president and spoke from Riyadh with International Edition's Susan Yaki about what the U.S. hopes the summit will accomplish.
They are looking for ways that they can agree on more and work together on more things in the Middle East. That's very broad, but generally it's, you know, there's some disagreement about how to approach all the chaos and all the political uncertainty and the way things are happening in the Middle East right now. They have different priorities, different ways of approaching how they should handle it. And so right now they're actually just discussing ways that they can work more closely. And that is a great hope here, that this dialogue continues. There will probably be some announcements afterwards on how they've deepened cooperation. Also some military assistance from the U.S., which is really important to the Gulf states. But beyond that, not a whole lot more other than to continue the dialogue.
One concern is the fight against the Islamic State.
That is a key priority for the United States. That is, there are three sessions. One is regional security, how they can work together more closely. The second session is really important, especially for the United States, and that is combating Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. The U.S. would like more cooperation and help from Arab states on that. The U.S. sees that as a top priority, not just for the U.S., but for global security. So a lot of the Arab states are more concerned about Iran and its actions in the region and sectarian wars, sectarian conflicts. And that's what they're worried about. To many of the Gulf states, that's the global priority. That's the key priority, the key security threat. So the second session will focus on what U.S. views as the greater threat, and that is Al-Qaeda and Islamic State. Now, the final session on this day will be on Iran, and that addresses, of course, the concerns of many of the Arab states.
And those concerns are?
Well, they're concerned that Iran continues to build up its military capabilities, continues missiles testing, continues to back many of the rebels in the region that are causing chaos and political failures, like in Yemen. That is a key example. Tehran backing the Houthis. So Saudi Arabia went in there with some costly military power to combat the Houthis. stems back to the regional rivalry between the Sunni majority Saudis and the Shia majority Iranians, the proxy war. So that's the big concern here. And these are all neighbors. So they view that as the greater threat and the more immediate threat to them. So all the very complex issues, a lot to tackle in one day. But I think the U.S. position is that this is a good time to address this because there are some fragile ceasefires right now in Yemen and also in Syria. The U.S. would like to see more of the focus on those, turn to the political process to continue to stabilize those states, and then more focus go to Islamic State and Al-Qaeda.
VOA White House correspondent Mary Alice Salinas speaking with my colleague Susan Yockey. President Obama has now gone on to Britain for meetings. He'll have lunch today with Queen Elizabeth, who is celebrating her 90th birthday. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa.
VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is VOA's International Edition. In U.S. politics, the five major party presidential candidates are crisscrossing the country, campaigning in advance of next Tuesday's next set of primary elections. This week, there were big wins for the frontrunners, Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Hillary Clinton in the state of New York, Trump's home state and the state in which Clinton lives and for which she served in the U.S. Senate. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more on the results from this week's New York State primary.
It was a big night in his home state for Republican frontrunner Donald Trump.
I have great, great admiration and praise for the city of New York and the state of New York. I can think of nowhere that I would rather have this victory. So we love you all. Have a great evening. We celebrate. And tomorrow morning, we go back to work.
Trump easily defeated rivals John Kasich and Ted Cruz. The billionaire businessman increased his delegate lead and took a major step towards securing the Republican Party's presidential nomination. Both Kasich and Cruz vowed to battle on in hopes of forcing a contested Republican convention in July. Kasich campaigned in Maryland in advance of its primary next week.
You know, I think they're going to make a pick my way. That's what I believe. And there's one other thing. You know, I'm the only one here with the positive message, the unifying message. I think the party ought to have a choice when it comes to that.
Cruz spoke to supporters in Pennsylvania, which also holds a primary next Tuesday.
Will we continue to live in the past with what we know no longer works, or will we move forward to a new and better place? The people in state after state have made it clear. They cry out for a new path.
In the Democratic primary, frontrunner Hillary Clinton scored a big win over resilient rival Bernie Sanders.
Thank you, New York! The race for the Democratic nomination is in the home stretch, and victory is in sight.
Clinton will take more delegates than Sanders in New York to add to her mounting lead. But Sanders vowed to fight on during a campaign stop in Pennsylvania and insisted he would be the stronger Democratic candidate in November.
And the American people are catching on that if we are going to prevent Trump or some other Republican from occupying the White House, which would be a disaster for our country, We have got the campaign to make sure that that does not happen.
Both Clinton and Trump got to vote for themselves in the primary because New York is their home state. Tuesday's results increased the chances that the two-party frontrunners will face off in the general election later this year. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And you can keep up to date on the race for the White House at our website, voanews.com.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
and
civilians.
Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
With all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit voanews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
And right there, you can find a podcast of this program under the Programs tab, International Edition. Hope you would check it out. U.S. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew has called it an exciting moment this week to announce that 19th century abolitionist Harriet Tubman will appear on the front of the $20 bill, being the first African-American to be so honored. Lew said it is the first in a series of steps to redesign American currency.
Harriet Tubman is one of the great American stories. A woman born a slave, illiterate for her whole life. She brought many, many people out of slavery through the Underground Railroad by time and again risking her own life to save others. She did intelligence for our army during the Civil War. After she worked to get the women's suffrage movement going. It's a great American story about how if you care about our democracy, it doesn't matter where you come from and it doesn't matter what you started out with, you can change our country. We're also going to be changing the 5 and the 10. And on the back of the 10, we're going to tell the story of women's suffrage more generally, with the leaders of the suffrage movement and a demonstration on the steps of the Treasury building for the women's right to vote. And on the back of the 5, we're going to bring to life the Lincoln Memorial with iconic events that have really changed our country.
Indeed, Lew said the target date for the redesigns, which will employ the most modern anti-counterfeit technology, is the year 2020. That's right, the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage in the U.S., and circulation will begin shortly after that. The redesigned $10 bill, as he was just referring to, will feature several female leaders on the back, including suffrage movement leaders Sojourner Truth and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, while the nation's first Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton, will be remaining on the front of the $10 bill. $5 bill will have President Lincoln on the front, as it has had, and former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt and civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. are on the back. Rice University presidential historian Douglas Brinkley speaks now with VOA's Victor Beatty. He says he's pleased about the choice of Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill. He said he's also glad that the proposal for the removal of Hamilton from the $10 bill did not come to pass.
Having the first woman on a bill is long overdue, and I think it was better to replace Andrew Jackson and not Alexander Hamilton. I say that because Hamilton was our first Secretary of Treasury, one of the very important founding fathers and one of the really key people in American history for understanding how our democracy works. Andrew Jackson has a more mixed record. He was certainly the hero of the Battle of New Orleans and was an extremely important president. We still honor Andrew Jackson in America with statues in Jacksonville, Florida, and Jackson, Mississippi being the capital of the state, but it was time to find a way to get a woman on the currency, and putting Harriet Tubman on the 20 seemed to me to be the best of all options.
What is significant about Harriet Tubman's life?
It's really the symbol of the freedom movement of the 19th century, somebody who was born a slave, who was abused by her owners, who was able to keep her integrity and dignity intact and run the Underground Railroad or be one of the key conductors of it during the Civil War, helping people from the South escape to the North for freedom. She furthermore went on to become one of the leading suffragists in the country. And a few years ago, President Barack Obama saved a part of Maryland, Eastern Shore, where Harriet Tubman spent a lot of time. And there's a movement underfoot to save her home burial site in Auburn, New York. She lived just a stone's throw away from William Seward. So she is what we would call a sustainable hero for the 21st century. Harriet Tubman, like Rosa Parks, is being taught in all of American schools as somebody who was able to kind of lead African-American people to a better world and a better life. So she's a symbol, really, of both the women's movement and the African-American freedom struggle, or the struggle for equal rights. She's symbolic of all of that. And so it's a day for celebration that she's now on the $20 bill.
And Democratic Party presidential frontrunner Hillary Clinton praised Tubman in a tweet, calling her a woman, a leader, and a freedom fighter, adding that she couldn't think of a better choice. Women have only twice before been featured on U.S. currency, the wives of nation's first president, Martha Washington, and Native American Pocahontas. In the 1800s, were on some currency. Two women suffragette, Susan B. Anthony and Native American Sacagawea, who guided the Lewis and Clark expedition, have appeared on U.S. coins. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
David Lukui used to be a tobacco farmer. Today he grows sunflowers in Kenya. He says, I planted 1 acre this season and I'm expected to harvest 15 bags. Sunflowers are easier to grow because they require less rain and nutrients. They grow fast and can be harvested about 4 times a year, so the seeds and the oil compressed from the seeds make sunflowers more profitable than farming maize and tobacco. Another farmer, Stephen Yongesa, works with a farmers group who buy seeds in bulk, and they hope to sell them to refineries sometime in the future. He says, in one day, we can process 1 sack of seed, which we package in 10 liters. This is a half-liter bottle of oil, which I sell for about 80 cents. Sunflower oil is rich in vitamin E and low in saturated fat, and while used in foods, it's also used to make soap and cosmetics and also animal feed. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us today. You know, each year, roughly from March through June, a small crustacean, that's right, that thrives in the wetlands of the U.S. states of Louisiana and Texas brings together a lot of people. They come, they sing, they dance, and, of course, they eat the crustacean. Crawfish, as they're known, can be found on menus just about anywhere in the country, but they're really popular on the U.S. Gulf Coast. VOA's Greg Flakus went to an annual crawfish festival for her report.
The band is playing Zydeco, a blend of traditional Louisiana Cajun music and the blues that was born in this region and goes well with crawfish. In spite of some light rain and gusty winds, hundreds of people came out to party at this racetrack in Brazoria County. When they weren't dancing to Zydeco, country, or blues music, they were eating crawfish.
It just means fun. I mean, it's the fun food. It's like you always eat with, you know, a group, and it's something that, you know, it's seasonal.
Harvested from coastal wetlands and rice fields, these creatures are not very pretty. But once they're boiled in spices, they look a lot better.
You let them boil about 2 to 3 minutes, and then you let them soak for about 15 minutes.
It takes a lot of work to peel the shells from the meat, but fans love it all.
Everything, texture, the taste, the spice. Enjoy.
The Brazoria County Crawfish Festival includes a variety of other foods as well as carnival rides and some more exotic events. Like the dog splash contest, in which canines pursuing a toy tossed by a trainer are judged by how far they can jump into a pool. Luxury sports cars brought out the inner child in some adults.
What we try to do is take the feel of a small town, friendly community fair, and just serve it up really big.
As the festival took place, a large storm was forming in the nearby Gulf of Mexico that would drench the area in record rain and cause widespread flooding. But the festival wrapped up just before the big storm arrived, so the crawfish lovers and music fans got their fill of both. Greg Flakus, VOA News, Angleton, Texas.
Certainly sounds like they're having a little fun, don't you think? Some of that same bad weather Greg just mentioned along the Texas coast, well, it's moving toward Louisiana, and the people there who are organizing the New Orleans Jazz Festival are praying for good weather, and in fact, they might get it. The 47th Annual Jazz Festival gets underway today. It's a blend of all genres of music, jazz, rock, zydeco, rap to pop, R&B, gospel. It's a big, big event, and people are looking forward to it. Among some of the entertainers, the Doobie Brothers frontman Michael McDonald will be there, jazz drummer Jason Marsalis, and, of course, the very popular gospel singer Alexis Spite. She won this year's BET singing competition. All worth checking out if you happen to be in New Orleans. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. Have a great and wonderful Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The 2015 Country Reports on Human Rights Practices, issued by the State Department in mid-April, saw the continuation of a disturbing trend, that of tightening of restrictions on civil society and private citizens, particularly journalists and voices of the opposition. In every part of the world, we see an accelerating trend by both state and non-state actors to close the space for civil society, to stifle media and internet freedom, to marginalize opposition voices, and in the most extreme cases, to kill people or drive them from their homes, wrote Secretary of State John Kerry in the report's introduction. The report noted that a number of authoritarian governments attempted to stifle civil society and activists both through harassment, intimidation, detention, and restrictions on their ability to operate, as well as by implementing very broad counterterrorism or national security laws to control the freedom to assemble and to suppress dissent, and by increasing the bureaucratic obstacles non-governmental organizations had to navigate. Such governments stifle civil society because they fear public scrutiny. To justify their repressive actions, they present a variety of excuses. They may point out that civil society is not elected and is therefore not representative or accountable, that foreign NGOs undermine national sovereignty, or that regulating civil society is necessary to prevent financing of terrorism. However, such arguments become moot, according to the report, when one realizes that civil society does not have the power to force people into obeying their decisions, and that it is influential because it reflects a grassroots need within a community. The report notes also that terrorist groups like Daesh make efforts to drive off, shut down, or kill civil society activists as soon as they take control of a community. According to the report, terrorist groups take such action because local grassroots civil society organizations can sometimes stand up against violent extremists more effectively than a government security agency. In his remarks at the rollout of the publication, Secretary Kerry said, "The choice some governments offer between freedom and stability is thus a false one, for freedom is the foundation for lasting stability." Kerry concluded that the frequently grim examples detailed in this report strengthen our resolve to promote fundamental freedoms, to support human rights defenders, and to document and promote accountability for violations of human rights.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.